Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you for being here. Thank you to the Thomistic Institute here in Trinity College for the invitation. Can everybody hear me? Yes? Okay, good. Most of you should have a handout. I've provided it to assist you with this lecture. How can a good God allow evil is not an easy question. And the answer from a Thomist perspective or the response to this question isn't straightforward either. That doesn't mean it's not convincing, but it is complex. We need to look at some of our presuppositions that govern our outlook on the world in order to begin to address this question, including the relationship between God and the world. Right. A popular objection against the belief in a God who extends his providence or care over the world pretty much runs as follows. If God is good and all-powerful, there should be no evil. But evil does occur, so therefore there is no omnipotent good God. Now, the argument is less than convincing. There may be good reasons, after all, why a good God permits evil. Just like a loving parent may, at times, allow her child to make mistakes, painful as they may be, in order for the child to learn from those mistakes and mature as a person. But leaving that aside, tonight I want to discuss some of the more sophisticated arguments that Thomas Aquinas proposes to deal with the challenge of evil and suffering. Now, before I unpack some of Thomas's responses, I need to remind you of a popular distinction between moral and natural evil. Moral evil refers to what we call sin. Natural evil refers to things that inhibit our fulfillment or can even destroy us, but that are not caused by human beings. So murder and rape are instances of sin, but blindness or heart failure are natural evils. Now, even though those two cannot always be neatly separated, as the consequences of the climate crisis demonstrates, I will mainly focus on natural evil or suffering in this paper. In order to tackle the mystery of natural evil, I need to say a few words about evil as an absence of goodness. I also need to address the way God relates to the world, which is a topic of divine and creaturely causality. And that is key to understanding divine providence or the care that God extends over our world. Finally, I will say a few words about the gratuitousness or disinterestedness of love. So the paper sort of evolves from a more philosophical to more theological considerations. So on your handout, you'll see that the first part deals with evil as an absence of goodness. When an atheist claims that there is no God, given the occurrence of evil, one could respond in a number of ways. One way of responding consists in saying that the occurrence of suffering has little to do with God. Natural evil just happens, so to say. God would be making space for the created world, and this implies the possibility, and the real occurrence, I should add, of evil. This approach was popular in the 20th century amongst theologians who espouse a notion of a kenotic or self-emptying God. But it actually has a remote pre-modern ancestry. Perhaps some of you have heard of Manichaeism, which argues that the world is very dualistic. There are always two supreme principles. There is a good God and an evil one. And all the evil in this world comes from the evil principle. There is good, there is evil, there is soul and body, there is spirit and matter, there is male and female, there is a good God and an evil one, and so forth. Before he became a Christian, Saint Augustine was a Manichae. When, however, Augustine came across the writings of what we today would call Neoplatonists, he encountered a major insight, namely the notion that evil is an absence of goodness. Privatio boni in Latin, a privation of the good. So it's important to remember that this is originally a non-Christian philosophical insight. But Saint Augustine and the Christian tradition after him, including Thomas Aquinas, adopted this notion of evil as an absence of goodness with enthusiasm. It's not surprising, because it is a deep and fruitful insight. To describe evil as an absence of goodness, the way, for instance, blindness is an absence of sight, has two immediate implications. First, by its very nature, evil is not something positive in the sort of ontological sense of the word. So we can only begin to fathom evil if we know the good that it negates. To give you an analogy, in a world where humans had never enjoyed eyesight but had always been blind from birth, we would not consider blindness an evil. So evil can only be understood in light of the goodness that is absent. And that implies that evil, in its own right, becomes something intellectually elusive or perhaps even inherently incomprehensible. Secondly, if evil is an absence or a negativity, it cannot be said to be directly caused by God. Everything that God causes is good. So God is not the cause of evil, at least not directly. Now note the importance of the word directly. I'm going to come back to that later. For now, let's unpack the notion of absence of goodness in some more detail. When Thomas argues that the existence of evil is not incompatible with a good God, he offers an analogy. Namely, he refers to silence that adds to the beauty of a hymn. Thomas's point is obviously not that evil is a good thing, which would be a contradiction. His point is, rather, that the occurrence of evil may contribute to a better world the way a musical pause may contribute to the overall beauty of a musical piece by assisting us, for instance, in discerning the development of a new musical theme. So again, the point of the analogy is not that evil is good. It simply means that God may permit instances of evil in light of a greater good. Evil is not a good, just as silence is not a beautiful sound. But our appreciation of beautiful sounds, such as in the symphony, may be enhanced by musical pauses and the use of silence. This is a total aside. There is a symphony by Anton Bruckner, and we're commemorating the anniversary of the 200 years of his birth, and it's called the Pausen Symphony, because there's so many stops and goes in the music. Bruckner writes music like that in order to allow the listener to sort of understand the musical argument, so to speak. Anyways, referring to a greater good, so evil is for the sake of a greater good, may perhaps evoke skepticism, as if I'm trying to justify evil after all. But this is not my aim, and nor is it Thomas's? But I do think that it's not incoherent to consider, for instance, the death of a loved one, a major evil, and yet a proof of the fact that all humans must die, if only because a finite material world in which we were all to live forever would not be viable in a meaningful way. It would be living hell and a theater of unending competition, oppression, and rivalry over resources even more scarce than at present. So this example illustrates that particular instances of natural evil, such as a loved one who dies, can actually be considered a good from a higher perspective, a meta perspective, if you like. Now, I'll come back to the notion of a greater good at a later stage. So, I've suggested that Thomas claims that evil can only be understood in light of a goodness that is absent, as a negativity, as something that is actually parasitic upon goodness. So you need goodness and an understanding of goodness to make sense of evil insofar as we can, just like you need awareness of light to discern its absence, namely darkness. Now, on account of this, and this is on your handout, Thomas argues that the very occurrence of evil can actually be a pointer, albeit a negative one, to goodness. This is quite extraordinary. When Thomas discusses the popular objection that the existence of evil excludes belief in a good, all-powerful God, if God exists, whence comes evil, he writes, and I quote, "But it could be argued to the contrary. If evil exists, God exists. For there would be no evil if the order of good were taken away, since its privation is evil. But this order would not exist if there were no God." End of quotation. So if evil exists, God exists, because implicitly it confirms the existence of a broader goodness. Now, all of this may still sound abstract and metaphysical, and it is metaphysical. And our outlook on the world is less metaphysical or philosophical and more psychological than Thomas's. But it is not difficult to transpose the metaphysical insight of evil as an absence of goodness into a more existentialist key, namely, in terms of what Eduard Schillebeek, the Flemish Dominican, has called negative contrast experiences. What does that mean? Well, whenever we cry out in the face of suffering, "This is not how it should be," our very revolt implicitly affirms the overall goodness of the world. So our revolt and indignation only makes sense in light of an implicit affirmation of the thesis that goodness has generally overall primacy over evil in this world, even if not in every instance. Second part of the paper on divine providence and causality and secondary causes. I said earlier in passing that God is not the direct cause of evil. So in this section, I want to examine in some more detail what it means for God to be a cause, because this discussion has an immediate bearing on how we understand divine providence, that is, the care that God extends over this world. So I appreciate this is a little bit technical, but hopefully the handout will assist you in coming to terms with this material. First, I need to return to my earlier claim that for Thomas, God does not directly cause evil. Here I need to recall the distinction between moral evil, or sin, and natural evil, or suffering. God does not cause moral evil, or sin. nor directly, nor indirectly. Nor does he will it. Thomas makes it quite clear that moral evil or sin is opposed to the fulfillment of the divine will and love. Natural evil, like any evil, is a privation or an absence of goodness and can therefore not be directly willed by God either. But Thomas does affirm that God is the indirect or accidental cause of natural evil, namely insofar as it serves a greater good. When I explain this to my students, they're always shocked. Does Thomas really say that God is the cause of evil, albeit indirectly? The answer is, insofar as we talk about natural evil, yes. Thomas's perhaps surprising claim that God is the indirect cause of evil, of natural evil, actually follows from the claim that evil is an absence of goodness. So, if you're producing beautiful sounds as a composer, such as Bruckner, it makes no sense to claim that the pause or the silence that Bruckner introduces is directly caused by Bruckner as a maker of beautiful sounds. But indirectly, of course, he does cause it by writing a symphony in which there are pauses or silences. So to apply this analogy to divine providence and causality, God creates a world in which bad things happen, even though he does not directly create or cause those bad things. Thus, when Thomas asks, is good the cause of natural evil? He answers the question affirmatively, for God is the indirect cause insofar as he creates a finite world of transient, fragile things subject to decay and death. Now, the claim that God is the indirect cause of natural evil is an immediate consequence of Thomas's rejection of metaphysical dualism as we found it in the thought of Manichaeism mentioned earlier. Thus, Thomas's claim that natural evil finds its ultimate origin in the goodness of God is, paradoxically, a positive claim that implies an affirmation of the primacy of goodness. It basically suggests that evil is not on the same metaphysical level as goodness, but evil is always parasitic, so to speak, upon goodness. In your handout, you will see that I think there are two main reasons why modern people find it hard to believe that the world is governed by a benevolent God who exerts his care or providence over the world, or indeed find the belief in God altogether questionable. The first reason why we find it hard to make sense of divine providence is that we have a one-dimensional understanding of causality in modernity. Modern people restrict causality mainly to efficient causality. In contrast, Thomas construes divine causality not primarily as efficient, but rather as final. Again, this is a bit technical, and I'll try to unpack it. Thomas, following Aristotle, operates with a notion of fourfold causality. So let's recall this fourfold causality briefly and start with efficient causality. In the building of a house, the bricklayer is the efficient or the agent cause. Secondly, Thomas identifies a material cause. As the word indicates, this may refer to matter, such as bricks and mortar. It can also refer to anything that can receive a form. Formal causality, in turn, refers, as the name indicates, to the presence of the form, which makes a material thing into what it is. So the animals that we call cats and dogs differ because of their feline and canine forms, respectively. Again, if you build a house, you do so according to a plan, perhaps designed by an architect. That plan is the formal cause. Final causality, which is of primary importance in Thomas's worldview, refers to the goal or the end as to why we act. We build a house to live in, to give us shelter from the elements. This is its end or its function. So remember, efficient causality, material causality, formal causality, and final causality. Now, when Thomas discusses God as the efficient cause, he does not interpret agent or efficient causality in mechanistic terms, which is effectively the way we would normally do it in the modern world. Mechanistic terms, the way one billiard ball moves another. But he understands efficient causality in what we would call transcendental terms. Transcendental is a technical term, and it means or refers to the condition of possibility of, in this case, creaturely action. Thomas means to convey that our power to act or change depends on other powers in act, and that there's ultimately one power that makes this possible. Now, and this is the key point, unlike in a mechanistic pattern, this higher power does not determine the outcome of the action as such, the way one billiard ball will determine the direction and the speed of another billiard ball, but it enables the action. And that's a crucial difference. So Thomas's God is not a sort of mildly incompetent micromanager of Universe Inc. God, as creator and providential carer, enables creatures to act, but does not predetermine their actions. God bestows being upon things, he gives them existence, but he allows creatures to perform their own causality, what we call the secondary causality. So, I cannot do anything without the creative act of God, who continually bestows being or existence upon me, and who sustains every move I make. But it remains my move. I mean, obviously, there's an understanding of creation at work here. Creation is a continuous process. God is creating me here and now. If God stopped creating me out of nothing, here and now, I would just vanish into nothingness. Okay, so creation is beyond time and is an eternal process. I am created in time by an eternal act of God. And it is, in that sense, continuous. Creaturely and divine causality are not in competition with one another. As Thomists would say, it is not a zero-sum game, because divine causality is the condition of possibility of creaturely operation and causality. So divine causality effectively operates at a transcendental level, which as a condition of possibility, which is why creaturely and divine actions are not in competition with one another, but divine causality supports creaturely operation. So it makes no sense to ask, the fact that I'm here tonight giving this lecture, is this due to my operation or to God's? And if it is due to both, which is effectively what Thomas is saying, how should we allocate percentages, like 80% mine and 20% God? For Thomas, obviously, it is 100% God's doing that I'm here tonight, and it is 100% my own. So they're not mutually exclusive. Creaturely and divine causality are not in competition with one another. In terms of divine providence, final causality is the most important one. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that everything acts for the sake of goodness. And the ultimate goodness is God.
God is directly or indirectly the final cause of every operation whatsoever. You have a quotation in the handout which says, "For since every operation is for the sake of some good, real or apparent," for instance, in the case of sin, you pursue an apparent good, but it's not a real good, but you're still pursuing a good. I'll come back to the quotation in a second, but Thomas's example is pretty much always the same. He takes the example of adultery. The adulterer is pursuing something good, namely pleasure. And pleasure is a good thing. But of course, to pursue sexual pleasure outside of marriage is problematic for Thomas. So the sinner is still pursuing a good, namely pleasure. So in this instance, the good is real, but it's taken out of its appropriate context, so to speak, which makes it an apparent good. So even when we sin, we are actually pursuing a good. This is an indication of Thomas's positive understanding of the goodness of the world, really. Anyhow, back to our quotation. "For since every operation is for the sake of some good, real or apparent, and nothing is good either really or apparently, except in as far as it participates in a likeness to the supreme good, which is God, it follows that God himself is the cause of every operation as its end." So, when something bad happens, for instance, my eyesight is going, the key question for Thomas is not, how did this come about? And is God as efficient cause responsible for my misery? But rather, what is the purpose of this? And will it allow me to reach my final goal? So these are different questions. Thomas's questions have to do with the end or the goal. They are what we call teleological. They have to do with the telos, the goal. So far, in this section, I have said that our mechanistic notion of efficient causality is deeply alien to Thomas. If you apply our modern notion of efficient causality to divine causality, you forget that God is not a cause on a level with creaturely causes. You overlook the fact that God is the transcendental cause, the condition of possibility of creaturely things and their operation. And you ignore that God is not a thing besides creaturely things, who operate allegedly then in competition with him. I also mentioned that divine providence needs to be primarily understood in terms of final causality or the goal. This brings me to the second reason why we find it hard to make sense of providence. The first being, as you remember, a different understanding of efficient causality. Final causality for Thomas is eschatological in nature. Eschatology, as you may know, has to do with the teaching about final things like afterlife, heaven and hell, and so on. Now, so divine providence for Thomas is eschatological in nature. So divine providence does not refer so much to the temporal well-being of individual human beings, or even societal achievements in history, such as the nations or Europe's expansion, as allegedly an expression of divine providence in the 18th century. But it refers rather to the dwelling of rational creatures in the presence of God for all eternity. The fact that this eschatological perspective has faded from the popular imagination is one of the reasons why people today find it difficult to make sense of the doctrine of divine providence. Providence and governance are concerned with how God extends his care and governance to every one of us while guiding us towards salvation. So God makes sure that all things work for our ultimate good, which is to dwell in his presence for all eternity, rather than for any temporal goods per se. And the well-being of the body is one of those temporal goods. This is not to deny that God creates and upholds all things in existence, bestows their form, grants their operation, and draws them to Him through the pursuit of their own perfection. But the aim of divine providence is not temporal well-being of creatures, not even of humans. The end of providence is, ultimately, God Himself and our participation in God. So when things go bad in a temporal sense, like, let's say, my health is declining or I lose my job, these are temporal things, and ultimately providence is not about those things. It is about, ultimately, about knowing and loving God here and in the afterlife. Even if we accept all of this, some people might say that there is an excess of suffering and evil that cannot be accounted for in a theologically satisfactory manner. And this brings me to the third part of the paper, the gratuity of love. There is a seeming randomness built in the state of temporal affairs, in which God sends the rain to the just and the unjust alike. And afflictions do not appear to be necessarily bound up with any sins we may have committed. Now, part of the theological tradition had suggested that our sufferings and afflictions are the result of sin, if not our own personal sin, at least original sin, the sin committed by Adam and Eve in the fall, in the Garden of Eden. Now, Thomas qualifies this view considerably and proposes an alternative approach, which is actually partly at odds with this. For starters, Thomas suggests that we should consider afflictions not so much as penal, not so much as punishments, but rather as medicinal in character, not just to heal past sins, but also to prevent future ones, or even as an inducement to some good. Thomas adds, and I think you have this on your handout as well, in this way, a person is sometimes afflicted without any fault of his own, yet not without cause. End of quote. Now, these are charged words. Presumably, Thomas has the book of Job in mind, where the protagonist is being subjected to immeasurable suffering, even though he has led a righteous life. Now, it should be clear that the claim that in some instances God inflicts sufferings on those who are free from guilt effectively contradicts the first, more traditional view, which had proposed the exact opposite, namely that all suffering is because of sin. An important theme, which I do not develop in this paper, in Thomas's soteriology or theory of salvation, is the idea that afflictions can be a means of growing in conformity with Christ's passion and may assist us in attaining the fruition of God. So through suffering, we can become more Christ-like. That's it. So Christ didn't become human to do away with suffering. In a sense, Christ became human, lived and suffered and died in order to allow us to participate in Him, amongst other things, through suffering. But even this idea, pastorally important as it is, should not be adduced as a proper cause for random afflictions, lest we are in danger of legitimizing suffering. So the challenge is, therefore, can we both affirm the utter absurdity or arbitrariness of afflictions, and therefore avoid the trap of an easy and irreverent legitimation of suffering of innocent people, in the sense of suffering is good for you, right? I mean, that's appalling theology. On the other hand, can we claim that sufferings are somehow part of the providence of God. So can we both affirm the absurdity of it and yet say it is part of the divine, of the divine plan and providence? So in my view, we can argue that the seeming arbitrariness itself may be a part of providence. The reason for this randomness may be that in a material, finite world, it can safeguard a gratuitous, non-calculative response to God's love. To understand this, we need to remember that Thomas characterizes our love for God, or charity, in terms of friendship. It is therefore utterly gratuitous or non-instrumentalist. So we are friends with God, not for the sake of any benefits that may accrue to us, but simply because we love God in his own right, for himself. This, by the way, applies to friendship amongst humans as well. If we are genuinely on friendly terms with someone, friendship is its own reason. We're not friends with someone for the sake of advantages that may accrue to us. Think of the difference between a friend and a social networker. A social networker is basically targeting the benefits and the advantages that come with friendship. He or she is not acting like a friend. Whereas you are friends with somebody just because you are friends with somebody for the sake of friendship. It should be clear, as the book of Job illustrates, that the afflictions that befall us and that cannot be challenged or remedied, an important qualification, in their very meaninglessness and arbitrariness, provide us with an opportunity to become schooled in a love for God that is non-calculating or disinterested and utterly gratuitous, not unlike God's own love for his creation. In the prologue of the book of Job, Satan claims that Job's fear of the Lord is not for nothing or in vain. In other words, Satan alleges that Job's adherence to God is calculating and instrumentalist. That is, Job loves God because of the temporal goods he has gained from God. Now, Thomas obviously rejects this, commenting that Satan unjustly deprecates the deeds of Job as though he did them for the sake of earthly goods. And then he continues, and you have that quotation on your handout. So it is clear, says Thomas, that the good things which we do are not referred to earthly prosperity as a reward. Otherwise, it would not be a perverse intention if someone were to serve God because of temporal prosperity. The contrary is likewise true. Temporal adversity is not the proper punishment of sins. And this question, says Thomas, will be the theme dealt with in the entire book of Job. Thomas strongly resists the view that the randomness of temporal afflictions constitutes a sufficient refutation of the belief in providence. On the contrary, we can argue, although Thomas does not explicitly say this, that the seeming arbitrariness itself may be part of providence. And the reason this arbitrariness is present may be that in a material finite world, it can safeguard a gratuitous, non-calculative response to God's love. So paradoxically as it may seem, arbitrary suffering, in its very randomness, may be part of God's all-embracing providential care. I've come to my conclusion. When we are faced with major afflictions, we may be tempted to call out, "God, why are you doing this to me?" Now, Thomas gently reminds us that this question, if put like that, may be predicated upon a notion of divine causality that needs critical scrutiny. God is not the direct cause of natural evil. In that sense, he is not causing our affliction. But God has created a finite and fragile world in which suffering occurs. He does not directly cause these afflictions, but by the mere fact that he has created this finite world, he does cause afflictions indirectly. With an analogy that perhaps may appeal to you or not, this is a bit like a student who's disappointed with the result of his essay and blames the lecturer for giving him a bad mark. The lecturer does not want students to fail, but if they do not meet standards, she has to fail the student. She is not the direct cause of the failure, but only the indirect one. She does not directly cause the failure, nor does she prevent it, but she permits it. Of course, one could say, okay, I can see that God does not directly cause evil, which is an absence anyhow, and it's hard to conceive how we can positively cause a negative or an absence. So God does not cause blindness, but he creates a world in which blindness occurs. If so, the question then arises, could God have made our world better? Thomas deals with this question, and initially he says no, because it would no longer be our world as we know it, which is fair enough insofar as it goes. But when pushed, he admits that God could have made a different, better world in which there would be less suffering. He does not tell us why, and perhaps that is just as well. After all, theologians should acknowledge the mysteriousness of suffering, which may very well be a reflection of the mysteriousness of God himself. Towards the end of this paper, I alluded to the fact that the very randomness and arbitrariness of suffering may be an essential medium in which we can grow in love for God. A world without this kind of randomness and in which we would duly and promptly receive our just rewards would render freely given love impossible. So in their very meaninglessness and arbitrariness, afflictions therefore provide us with an opportunity to become schooled in a love for God that is non-calculating or disinterested and utterly gratuitous. So in their very arbitrariness, afflictions may perhaps remain part of God's providential care. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.